This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of How Full Is Your Bucket? Anniversary Edition by Donald O. Clifton, Ph.D. and Tom Rath. Performed by Tom Rath and Jeff Cummings. This audiobook includes a unique one-use-only access code that allows you to take the Clifton Strengths Finder assessment. If you purchase the MP3 CD or audio CD, your code will be located inside the packaging. If you purchase the download version, your download provider will email your code to you. This access code is valid for one use only. If you are a library patron, the code for the assessment discussed in this book is not available in this edition. If you want to take the assessment, you can purchase the book, which includes an access code to take the assessment, at any book retailer. This audiobook also includes a PDF of A Guide to Applying How Full Is Your Bucket in Teams and Organizations that accompanied the print edition. If you have purchased an audio CD version, look for the PDF on a separate disc. The PDF will appear as an additional file if you have purchased an MP3 CD or MP3 download.
Forward. Updated assessment and reports. The publication of Now Discover Your Strengths in 2001 launched a worldwide strengths revolution. To date, more than 12 million people have discovered their strengths, and tens of thousands more are discovering theirs every week. Gallup Press has published numerous strengths-based books, and Gallup Strengths Center has become a worldwide destination for strengths-based development. Since 2001, Gallup has continued to dedicate countless hours to developing our strengths science, the brainchild of the late Dr. Donald O. Clifton, who was named Father of Strengths-Based Psychology by the American Psychological Association. Part of that investment resulted in Clifton Strengths Finder 2.0, a refined upgrade of the original assessment for discovering your strengths. To ensure that you have the best possible experience in discovering and developing your strengths, we have made Clifton Strengths Finder 2.0 available in How Full Is Your Bucket? The updated assessment includes new reports and resources, including the Strengths Insight and Action Planning Guide. This guide goes far beyond the standardized reports of the older assessment by providing you with personalized insight statements unique to your specific combination of strengths. These highly customized strengths insights are an in-depth analysis of your top five strengths. They describe who you are in astonishing detail and provide you with a comprehensive understanding of yourself, your strengths, and what makes you stand out. These updated resources, in combination with How Full Is Your Bucket, give you the best opportunity to soar with your strengths at work and in your life. Preface to the Anniversary Edition. In the 5 years since the publication of How Full Is Your Bucket, I have heard from thousands of readers. Some have passed along their best strategies for boosting well-being, while others have shared their life stories. The one common thread is that people have learned to keep the bucket metaphor top of mind, and that has had a lasting impact on their lives, work, and closest relationships. Unfortunately, I have also heard from hundreds of readers who realized they were in an environment in which their bucket was constantly being emptied. In some cases, people have been in these destructive environments and relationships for years. And because the problem was more of an accumulation of negative moments than a single incident, there was no obvious breaking point that caused them to leave that environment. Yet when they considered the cumulative effect of thousands of negative daily interactions, these readers came to realize how much damage had been done. This constant negativity, or what our research teams at Gallup call active disengagement, runs rampant in workplaces around the world. This is not a problem that's isolated to just a few individuals. Active disengagement spreads rapidly, One negative person can quickly bring down the well-being of colleagues, customers, friends, and family members. On a more positive but related note, a 2008 study illustrated how one person's happiness continues to have a significant impact at a third degree of separation. It is likely that a disengaging work environment is not just bad for you and your work team's productivity, but it also could have a negative impact on the well-being of your friends and family members. Over the past 5 years, many readers have asked what they should do about a colleague who is perpetually disengaged. My best advice has always been to try and make the situation better, but if that fails, then to avoid the problematic person as much as possible. My assumption was that some people could not help but be disengaged in their jobs. As it turned out, my assumption was wrong. A few years ago, Gallup conducted a study that suggests otherwise. In that study, which has now become replicated multiple times, we conducted a randomized survey with more than 1,000 employees, asking them where their manager focused the most time and attention. A. On employee strengths. B. On employees' weaknesses. C. Neither of the above. The manager ignored employees. We found that one person, specifically the manager in this context, can eliminate almost all of the active disengagement in a workplace if he or she primarily focuses on an employee's strengths. When people reported that their manager did not focus on their strengths or their weaknesses, the manager ignored employees, there was a 40% chance of them being actively disengaged on the job. If their manager focused primarily on weaknesses, and presumably was at least paying attention, things actually got better, and there was only a 22% chance of them being disengaged. But when a manager primarily focused on an employee's strengths, there was just a 1% chance of that employee being very negative or actively disengaged on the job. As you can see from the results of this study, it appears that disengagement is a curable problem, and it is a challenge that is within our own control. If we put enough time into focusing on the strengths of the people around us every day, it changes the entire environment. As you will learn in the pages that follow, it all starts with a focus on what is right in your interactions with other people. And every moment matters. Tom Rath, February 2009.
Introduction.
In the early 1950s, my grandfather, Don Clifton, was teaching psychology at the University of Nebraska when he noticed a major problem. The field of psychology was based almost entirely on the study of what is wrong with people. He began to wonder if it would be more important to study what is right with people. So, over the past 5 decades, Don and his colleagues conducted millions of interviews, focusing on the positive instead of the negative. Early in his research, Don discovered that our lives are shaped by our interactions with others. Whether we have a long conversation with a friend or simply place an order at a restaurant, every interaction makes a difference. The results of our encounters are rarely neutral. They're almost always positive or negative. And although we take these interactions for granted, they accumulate and profoundly affect our lives. During the course of Don's work in the 1990s, a new field of study emerged. Positive psychology, which focuses on what is right with people. Today, many of the world's leading scientists study the effects of positive emotions. In 2002, Don's pioneering work was recognized by the American Psychological Association, which cited him as the grandfather of positive psychology and the father of strength psychology. That same year, Don learned that an aggressive and terminal cancer had spread throughout his body. Knowing his time was limited, he spent his final months doing what he did best and what people who knew him well would have expected, helping others focus on the positive. Although Don had already written several books, including the bestseller Now Discover Your Strengths, he asked me to join him in writing one last book, one based on a theory he created in the 1960s. People had been asking Don to write this book for decades as a result of the theory's popularity. Over the last 40 years, more than 5,000 organizations and 1 million people have applied this theory. And people always passed it along to friends, colleagues, and loved ones. Based on a simple metaphor of a dipper and a bucket, Don's theory carried profound implications and simplified his life's work for others. So in his final months, Don and I worked night and day to assemble the most compelling discoveries he had gathered over a half century of work. Although Don was undergoing chemotherapy and radiation, we continued to work on this book whenever he had the energy, which was the majority of the time. We sat in his study for hours, reviewing the research, statistics, and stories we thought you would find compelling. As Don's health deteriorated, I read sections to him and took notes on his feedback. He reviewed every section, wanting each story and insight to resonate with you. For my part, I was honored to be Don's partner in creating this book. He was my mentor, teacher, role model, and friend. We were exceptionally close, and I cherished the time we had together. I had always been motivated and inspired by his vision. And Don knew that I had been touched deeply by this theory throughout my life. As we will describe in Chapter 4, applying Don's theory of the dipper in the bucket energized and possibly saved me in my own battles with cancer. In hindsight, I think this project also gave Don additional energy in the final stages of his fight with cancer. He had spent his life trying to make the world a better place, one person at a time, and he understood that completing this book would make a difference. We finished our first draft of this book just weeks before his death in September of 2003. Over the 79 years of Don's life, he touched millions of individual lives through his books, teaching, and the global business he built. Don reached so many people as a result of his unwavering belief in helping individuals and organizations focus on what is right. As you listen to this book, we hope that you will discover the power of bucket filling in your own life.
The theory of the dipper and the bucket.
Each of us has an invisible bucket. It is constantly emptied or filled, depending on what others say or do to us. When our bucket is full, we feel great. When it's empty, we feel awful. Each of us also has an invisible dipper. When we use that dipper to fill other people's buckets, by saying or doing things to increase their positive emotions, we also fill our own bucket. But when we use that dipper to dip from others' buckets, by saying or doing things that decrease their positive emotions, we diminish ourselves. Like the cup that runneth over, a full bucket gives us a positive outlook and renewed energy. Every drop in that bucket makes us stronger and more optimistic. But an empty bucket poisons our outlook, saps our energy, and undermines our will. That's why every time someone dips from our bucket, it hurts us. So we face a choice every moment of every day. We can fill one another's buckets, or we can dip from them. It's an important choice, one that profoundly influences our relationships, productivity, health, and happiness.
Chapter 1. Negativity Kills.
When we started writing this book, the first question I asked my grandfather was, "Why did you begin studying what is right with people?" Don answered my question without a moment's hesitation. His review of one specific case study had altered the entire focus of his career and life. And this study was about as far as possible from a positive or inspiring story. Following the Korean War, Major William E. Mayer, who would later become the U.S. Army's chief psychiatrist, studied 1,000 American prisoners of war who had been detained in a North Korean camp. He was particularly interested in examining one of the most extreme and perversely effective cases of psychological warfare on record, one that had a devastating impact on its subjects. American soldiers had been detained in camps that were not considered especially cruel or unusual by conventional standards. The captive soldiers had adequate food, water, and shelter. They weren't subjected to common physical torture tactics of the time, such as having bamboo shoots driven under their fingernails. In fact, fewer cases of physical abuse were reported in the North Korean POW camps than in prison camps from any other major military conflict throughout history. Why, then, did so many American soldiers die in these camps? They weren't hemmed in with barbed wire. Armed guards didn't surround the camps, yet no soldier ever tried to escape. Furthermore, these men regularly broke rank and turned against each other, sometimes forming close relationships with their North Korean captors. When the survivors were released to a Red Cross group in Japan, they were given the chance to phone loved ones to let them know they were alive. Very few bothered to make the call. Upon returning home, the soldiers maintained no friendships or relationships with each other. Mayer described each man as being in a mental, solitary confinement cell, without any steel or concrete. Mayer had discovered a new disease in the POW camps, a disease of extreme hopelessness. It was not uncommon for a soldier to wander into his hut and look despairingly about, deciding there was no use in trying to participate in his own survival. He would go into a corner alone, sit down, and pull a blanket over his head, and he would be dead within 2 days. The soldiers actually called it give-up-itis. The doctors labeled it marasmus, meaning, in Mayer's words, a lack of resistance, a passivity. If the soldiers had been hit, spat upon, or slapped, they would have become angry. Their anger would have given them the motivation to survive. But in absence of motivation, they simply died, even though there was no medical justification for their deaths. Despite relatively minimal physical torture, marasmus raised the overall death rate in the North Korean POW camps to an incredible 38%, the highest POW death rate in U.S. military history. Even more astounding was that half of the soldiers died simply because they had given up. They had completely surrendered, both mentally and physically. How could this have happened? The answers were found in the extreme mental tactics that the North Korean captors used. They employed what Mayer described as the ultimate weapon of war.
The ultimate weapon.
Mayer reported that the North Koreans' objective was to deny men the emotional support that comes from interpersonal relationships. To do this, the captors used four primary tactics. The first one was informing. The second, self-criticism. The third, breaking loyalty to leadership and country. And the fourth was withholding all positive emotional support. To encourage informing, the North Koreans gave prisoners rewards such as cigarettes when they snitched on one another. But neither the offender nor the soldier reporting the violation was punished. The captors encouraged this practice for a different reason. Their intent was to break relationships and turn the men against each other. The captors understood that the soldiers could actually harm each other if they were encouraged to dip from their comrades' buckets every day. To promote self-criticism, the captors gathered groups of 10 or 12 soldiers and employed what Mayer described as a corruption of group psychotherapy. In these sessions, each man was required to stand up in front of the group and confess all the bad things he had done, as well as all the good things he could have done but failed to do. The most important part of this tactic was that the soldiers were not confessing to the North Koreans, but to their own peers. By subtly eroding the caring, trust, respect, and social acceptance among the American soldiers, the North Koreans created an environment in which buckets of goodwill were constantly and ruthlessly drained. The third major tactic that the captors employed was breaking loyalty to leadership and country. The primary way they did this was by slowly and relentlessly undermining a soldier's allegiance to his superiors. The consequences were ghastly. In one case, a colonel instructed one of his men not to drink the water from a rice paddy field because he knew the organisms in the water might kill him. The soldier looked at his colonel and remarked, "Buddy, you ain't no colonel anymore. You're just a lousy prisoner like me. You take care of yourself, and I'll take care of me." The soldier died of dysentery a few days later. In another case, 40 men stood by as three of their extremely ill fellow soldiers were thrown out of their mud hut by a comrade and left to die in the elements. Why did their fellow soldiers do nothing to help them? Because it wasn't their job. The relationships had been broken. The soldiers simply didn't care about one another anymore. But the tactic of withholding all positive emotional support while inundating soldiers with negative emotions was perhaps bucket dipping in its purest and most malicious form. If a soldier received a supportive letter from home, the captors withheld it. All negative letters, however, such as those telling of a relative passing away, or ones in which a wife wrote that she had given up on her husband's return and was going to remarry, were delivered to soldiers immediately. The captors would even deliver overdue bills from collection agencies back home within less than 2 weeks of the original postmark. The effects were devastating. The soldiers had nothing to live for and lost basic belief in themselves and their loved ones, not to mention God and country. Mayer said that the North Koreans had put the American soldiers into a kind of emotional and psychological isolation, the likes of which we had never seen.
Studying positivity.
Moved by this story of psychological torture and deprivation, and perhaps inspired by the hope that these soldiers had not suffered or died in vain, Don Clifton and his colleagues decided to study the flip side of this horrific equation. They wondered, if people can be literally destroyed by unrelenting negative reinforcement, can they be uplifted and inspired to a greater degree by similar levels of positivity? In essence, they asked, can positivity have an even stronger impact than negativity? Their research to answer this question inspired the theory of the dipper and the bucket. The theory is based on the following principles. Everyone has an invisible bucket. We are at our best when our buckets are overflowing, and at our worst when they are empty. Everyone also has an invisible dipper. In each interaction, we can use our dipper to either fill or to dip from others' buckets. Whenever we choose to fill others' buckets, we in turn fill our own. The theory of the dipper and the bucket has been investigated, applied, and embraced by millions around the world over the past half century. People who have heard this theory found it to be inspiring and easily applicable in their everyday lives. Most importantly, it's a theory you can put to work to make your life better, right now. In this program, you will find a simple language to use and share with others, a summary of research discoveries that are applicable in your daily life, true dipper and bucket stories, ways to eliminate negativity from your workplace and life, and 5 proven strategies for increasing positive emotions.
Chapter 2. Positivity, Negativity, and Productivity.
Most of us will never endure the kind of psychological torture that the American POWs suffered during the Korean War. Yet we all experience positive and negative interactions every day that influence how we feel and behave. Just because these interactions are commonplace and often undramatic doesn't mean they do not matter. They do. While most of our negative experiences will not kill us, they can slowly but surely erode our well-being and productivity. Fortunately, positive experiences, or bucket filling, can be even more powerful.
Bucket filling in organizations.
Although bucket filling goes far beyond the concepts of recognition and praise, these are 2 critical components for creating positive emotions in organizations. In fact, we have surveyed more than 4 million employees worldwide on this topic. Our latest analysis, which includes more than 10,000 business units and more than 30 industries, has found that individuals who receive regular recognition and praise increase their individual productivity, increase engagement among colleagues, are more likely to stay with their organization, receive higher loyalty and satisfaction scores from customers, and have better safety records and fewer accidents on the job. To put this into perspective, think about the greatest recognition you have ever received in the workplace. Chances are, it caused you to feel better about your organization and, in turn, become more productive. Great recognition and praise can immediately transform a workplace. And just one person can infuse positive emotions into an entire group by filling buckets more frequently. Studies show that organizational leaders who share positive emotions have work groups with a more positive mood, enhanced job satisfaction, greater engagement, and improved group performance. One CEO we know, Ken, claims that bucket filling is his secret weapon as a leader. He has developed very targeted ways to increase positive emotions in the large organization that he runs. In Ken's frequent travels around the globe, He always stops by his company's local offices. And he doesn't stop by to spy on his employees or just to meet with upper management. Instead, his primary intent is to energize the people in each workplace. Before arriving, Ken recalls successes and achievements he has heard over the past few months involving people in that office. As soon as he arrives, Ken casually visits with these individuals and congratulates them. He may offer kudos to an employee who recently got married or had a child, or praise someone who gave a great presentation. His favorite line is, "I've been hearing a lot of good talk behind your back." The most enjoyable part of spreading positivity for Ken is to watch the energy move through the network once he sets it in motion. He realized that he could light up an entire workplace with a few brief but very energizing conversations. "I discovered that bucket filling is an extraordinarily powerful leadership strategy," Ken says. As a result of this approach, thousands look to him for motivation and guidance.
Killing productivity.
Of course, there is a flip side. Right now, the majority of us don't give or receive anywhere near the amount of praise that we should. As a result, we're much less productive, and in many cases, completely disengaged in our jobs. According to the U.S. Department of Labor, the number one reason people leave their jobs is because they do not feel appreciated. But the problem doesn't stop there. One study of healthcare workers found that when employees were working for a boss they disliked, they had significantly higher blood pressure. According to British scientist George Fieldman, this boss-induced hypertension could increase the risk of coronary heart disease by 1/6 and the risk of stroke by 1/3. There was both a statistically and clinically significant elevation during the time the people had the boss they didn't like, says Fieldman, a psychologist and psychotherapist. People who work with bosses they've really hated constantly for years would probably be quite vulnerable to heart disease because of the elevation of blood pressure in the long term. Where productivity is concerned, it would be better for organizations if people who are overly negative stayed home. When they do show up for work, they are counterproductive. We all know these types of people. They walk around the office with glazed looks or move from cubicle to cubicle, stirring up trouble with whining, complaining, and even paranoia. Our estimates suggest that there are more than 22 million workers in the United States alone who are extremely negative or actively disengaged. This rampant negativity is not only disheartening, it's expensive. It costs the U.S. economy between $250 and $300 billion every year in lost productivity alone. When you add workplace injury, illness, turnover, absences, and fraud, the cost could surpass $1 trillion per year, or nearly 10% of the United States gross domestic product. These costs are not specific to the United States. They exist to varying degrees in every country, industry, and organization we have studied. And our figures are conservative. To estimate costs accurately, we only accounted for the direct impact that actively disengaged employees have at work. We quantified the productivity, or lack thereof, occurring in each person's own workspace. In analyzing the data, we had to assume that each disengaged employee simply sat in his or her cubicle and didn't wreak havoc elsewhere. An unlikely assumption, of course. Most disengaged employees do plenty of things each day that bring others down with their own sinking ship.
Spiraling downward.
To bring these numbers to life, here's an example of the effect that just a small dose of negativity had on one employee. Does Laura's story sound familiar to you?
There I was, standing at the front of the room, ready to get into the best part of my presentation. I'd stayed up late the last two nights preparing. I had a great deal of knowledge and passion on this topic and wanted everything to be perfect. And I really hoped to impress my boss and colleagues. Everything was going well as I flipped through the first few slides. Then, a sudden technology glitch gave everyone a chance to start talking for a few minutes. I overheard Mike whispering to Beth that it looked like I'd been out late last night. I wanted to jump across the table and strangle him. Did I really look that bad? I tried to remain composed, but I was shaken. When my presentation was back up, it was time to get everyone focused again and proceed. As I tried desperately to regain everyone's attention, my insecurities grew. Were my first few points so boring that they were dreading the next part? Or did I look so bad that it was undermining my credibility? Finally, my boss realized that I was about to have a breakdown and refocused everyone's attention. Unfortunately, he did it by saying, "Laura does not look very happy with us. Maybe we should pay attention now." Ouch. Sometimes I can't believe the things people say out loud. Every ounce of confidence I had mustered to give this presentation was wiped out. Things went downhill after that.
We have all experienced situations when it seems nothing will go right no matter what you say or do. Maybe you feel like everyone is out to get you, and you even start to fixate on negative things about yourself. Spiraling downward isn't hard to do when your bucket is being emptied. Not only do you feel down, but you are less productive because of it, and you bring others down with you by reactively dipping from their buckets. When you interact with people on these days, they quickly sense and are affected by the negativity you radiate. It's not easy to hide. In fact, it's highly contagious. It is possible for just one or two people to poison an entire workplace. And managers who have tried moving negative people to other departments to alleviate the problem know that location, location, location doesn't apply to these people. They bring their negativity along with them wherever they go. Negative employees can tear through a workplace like a hurricane racing through a coastal town.
Scaring off customers.
Not surprisingly, work groups drained by excessive bucket dipping aren't only less productive and less profitable. They also have higher turnover, more accidents on the job, and lower customer satisfaction, innovation, and quality scores. And negative employees scare off customers. Think about the last time you called a customer service line and were treated poorly. After this experience, you might have said to yourself, "I'm never doing business with this company again." If you were really angry, you might have told others about your experience and recommended that they stop doing business with the company as well. This is the damage one negative employee can inflict on any business. Recently, we investigated the impact that a single employee can have on customers by studying 4,583 call center representatives from a major telecommunications company. We discovered three service representatives who scared off every single customer they spoke with in a given day, and those customers did not return. It is a serious problem when a company's employees are dipping from customers' buckets. The company would have been better off paying those three representatives to stay home. Fortunately, this study also identified seven service reps who retained and engaged every single customer with whom they spoke. Maybe you've been lucky enough to talk with a rep like this. One who listened to your problem, made sure you understood that you were heard, took care of your issues promptly, and left you feeling like he or she really cared about you as a person. Did you want to tell others about this first-class service? And are you still a customer to this day?
The recognition gap.
Managers, take note. Praise is rare in most workplaces. One poll found that an astounding 65% of Americans reported receiving no recognition for good work in the past year. And we have yet to find anyone who reports suffering from over-recognition. No wonder so many employees are disengaged. Although we need and want recognition and praise, the fact is, we don't get enough, and organizations suffer because of it. Most of the time, organizations begin formal recognition programs because someone in upper management has decided that monthly or quarterly award ceremonies will help raise employee morale. Sounds good, right? What happens is the old reliable Employee of the Month program. For the first few months, the program might actually work. There are usually at least a couple of people who have been top performers for a long time and deserve more recognition. These stars are appropriately showered with public praise. But after a while, management struggles with the inevitable question, who should be the next Employee of the Month? Once the executives reach a compromise, a lucky manager must stand in front of the room and say a bunch of nice, and often insincere, things about the recipient. The whole exercise ends up feeling like a sham to both the winner and the presenter. Eventually, everyone, regardless of merit, gets named Employee of the Month. All their smiling photographs appear on a board in the reception area. But the whole thing is gratuitous, and everyone knows it. The one who feels the worst, of course, is the employee who receives this recognition last. Why wouldn't he? Management waited months, or maybe more than a year, to praise his great work, which probably feels about as good as being picked last for a team in gym class. Of course, some organizations do provide meaningful, deserved, and individualized recognition. In Chapter 6, we provide suggestions on how your organization can do just that. Sincere and meaningful bucket filling increases the morale of any organization. Managers and employees who actively spread positive emotions, even in small doses, will see the difference immediately. And creating that difference can be inexpensive or even free. All it takes is a little initiative.
Chapter 3. Every Moment Matters.
Usually, we don't stop to consider the impact of brief interactions, but we experience literally hundreds of potential turning points in a given day, as illustrated by Tammy, a single mother with three children.
My day starts with a typical rush. As I'm trying to get ready for work, the kids are clamoring for breakfast. Although my 8-year-old and 11-year-old are content with cereal, my 6-year-old is demanding peanut butter and banana on toast. Eventually, I give in and make one piece as requested, and we sit down for a quick meal. After a single bite, my 6-year-old drops her breakfast on the floor. I watch in what feels like slow motion as it lands, chunky peanut butter side down. Her brother blurts out, "You made a mess." Then her older sister says, "You're supposed to eat it, you dummy." And I chime in too and tell her something she already knows, that she really should be careful next time.
Consider how it felt to be the 6-year-old at that moment. What if Tammy had quickly hit pause in her mind and given her daughter some positive encouragement instead of piling on and pointing out her mishap? Tammy's day continues.
I finally get everyone out the door and the kids to school, just in time. Then, as I'm driving into the lot at work, I thought I had finally caught a break. For the first time in recent memory, there is an open parking spot in the front row. So, I speed up a little to make sure I beat any other parking lot predators to the spot. Of course, the minute I get close, another driver has the same idea. Even though I know in my head that I was there first, I decide to defer to this woman with a courtesy wave, and I head toward the back of the lot. Then something strange happens on the way into the building. The driver is waiting there, holding the door for me as I enter the building. She introduces herself and thanks me for being so kind. We end up chatting for a while.
In the span of a few moments, the buckets of both women were filled. Tammy continues.
I get into the office, sit down in my less-than-spectacular cubicle, and check my electronic calendar. I see that my 10 a.m. appointment reads, "Performance Review with Bill." My stomach just sinks. I want to run home and call in sick. I know exactly what this means. Bill, my boss, must have interviewed my peers the day before and asked them all about my opportunities for improvement. Sure enough, the meeting confirms my suspicions. Bill has prepared a list of 8 things that I need to work on fixing over the next 6 months. Not once does he mention any of my recent successes, even though I had worked more than 70 hours last week to complete a major proposal. After what feels like a couple days, I leave his office in a lousy mood. I think to myself, why do I even stay with this company?
In a short period of time, Bill all but emptied Tammy's bucket. She continues.
Later on, I'm walking down the hall, and I run into Karen, one of the company's top executives. We had worked together briefly on last week's big proposal. As I pass Karen, she slows down and says, "Hi, Tammy. That was great work on the final section of our proposal last week." I'm just amazed that she even remembered my name. More than half of the people in my work group call me Tamara, which isn't even the name I prefer.
If Karen had just said, "Hi, Tammy," that might have been enough. But offering Tammy meaningful and specific praise made her day. her bucket was filled quickly. And the funny thing is, Karen might have thought she was just making a simple comment in passing. She probably couldn't imagine the positive impact.
Our negative culture.
Most of us want more positive emotions in our lives. We want to feel like Tammy did in her brief meeting with Karen more often, and like she did after her performance review less often. 99 out of every 100 people report that they want to be around more positive people. 9 in 10 report being more productive when they're around positive people. Unfortunately, wanting a more positive environment isn't enough. Most of us have grown up in a culture in which it's much easier to tell people what they did wrong instead of praising them when they succeed. Although this negativity-based approach might have evolved unintentionally, it nevertheless permeates our society at all levels. This focus on what is wrong is particularly evident in our school experiences. Instead of celebrating what makes each child unique, most parents push their children to fit in so that they don't stick out. This unwittingly stomps out individuality and encourages conformity, despite these parents' good intentions. And our schools, which are built around core curricula that students have to learn regardless of their interests or natural talents, reinforce this kind of thinking. When a child excels at a subject and receives an A, what happens? Rather than recognizing and developing areas of talent, teachers and parents skip past the A and focus on raising the lower grades on the report card. And very few principals or guidance counselors are known for calling students into the office to discuss outstanding grades. A recent Gallup poll measured parents' focus on their children's best grades compared to their focus on their worst grades across multiple countries and cultures. The question posed to parents was, "Your child shows you the following grades, English, A, Social Studies, A, Biology, C, Algebra, F. Which grade deserves the most attention from you?" The vast majority of parents in every country focused on the F. Unfortunately, parents get caught up in the "how can I get my kid into college" race instead of first considering what's best for the development of their sons or daughters. This isn't to say that parents should ignore the F in algebra, but why not start with a positive focus on the A's before working on strategies for improving the F? If parents at least begin these discussions on a more positive note, it could make for a more productive conversation. At least when students graduate and enter the working world, they have the opportunity to do what they want, right? This is their time to pursue their grand passions. Well, that may be true for a select few. Unfortunately, the majority of young people aren't selected for their first job on the basis of how well their natural talents fit their role. Think back to your first career-oriented job and see if this scenario sounds familiar. Essentially, you were hired for a job, then you were expected to change who you were to fit the role. If you struggled, then you may have had to endure a competency program designed to fix the problem. The weakness-based approach follows us throughout our lives, from school to the workplace.
They missed it.
More than 70 years ago, the fields of education and psychology overlooked an important study, one with implications that could have, and probably should have, altered the ensuing focus of human inquiry. It's possible that we've all been suffering from this oversight ever since. The study, conducted by Dr. Elizabeth Herlock in 1925, was designed to explore what would happen when fourth and sixth grade students in a math class received different types of feedback on their work. Herlock wanted to find out if it was more effective to praise, criticize, or ignore students. The outcome was to be determined by how many math problems each student had solved 2, 3, 4, and 5 days later. Children in the first group were identified by name and praised in front of the classroom for their good work. Children in the second group were also identified by name in front of the group, but they were criticized for their poor work. Those in the third group were completely ignored, although they were present to hear the others being praised and scolded. A fourth control group was moved to another room after the first test. Members of this group took the same tests, but they received no comments on their performance. students in both the praised and criticized groups did better after the first day. Then their performance changed dramatically. The students who were criticized showed a major decline in their test scores, and by days 3 and 4, they were performing on par with students who had been completely ignored. In contrast, the students who were praised experienced a major improvement after day 2 that was sustained through the end of the study. By the 5th day of this experiment, the group that received praise showed unequivocally stronger performance than the other study groups. The overall improvement by group was praised 71%, criticized 19%, and ignored 5%. You would think this study caused quite a stir among psychologists and educators, but it didn't. Until recently, the scientific community has focused almost exclusively on studying the effects of negative or traumatic moments. That focus is finally starting to change.
The emergence of positive psychology.
As a result of the positive psychology movement, the study of what is right with people, some of the world's leading academic minds are now devoting their careers to analyzing the effects of positive emotions. At the risk of greatly oversimplifying a decade of in-depth research, many of the world's most noted scientists have put negativity on trial and have found it guilty. These recent studies show that negative emotions can be harmful to your health and might even shorten your lifespan. We already know that one negative person can ruin an entire workplace, but negative emotions can also destroy relationships, families, and entire careers. In contrast, recent discoveries suggest that positive emotions are an essential daily requirement for survival. Not only do they improve your physical and mental health, but they can also provide a buffer against depression and illness.
Thousands of moments every day.
According to Nobel Prize-winning scientist Daniel Kahneman, we experience approximately 20,000 individual moments in a waking day. Each moment lasts a few seconds. If you consider any strong memory, positive or negative, you'll notice that the imagery in your mind is actually defined by your recollection of a precise point in time. And rarely does a neutral encounter stay in your mind. The memorable moments are almost always positive or negative. In some cases, a single encounter can change your life forever. In a recent Today segment, Katie Couric interviewed a young man named Brian Bennett, who had grown up in a troubled and abusive environment. He had struggled in school and had been picked on regularly at a young age. Now, Brian is a successful and well-adjusted adult. When Couric asked him, "What made the difference?" the young man responded without thinking twice. The defining moment in his life occurred when a grade school teacher simply told him that she cared about him and believed in him. This one small interaction turned Brian Bennett's life around. In another case, we asked Kristen, a management consultant, "What is the greatest recognition you have ever received?" Her answer? 3 words in an email. We then found out that when Kristen's mother passed away, a mentor at work whom Kristen had admired throughout her career wrote her a special note. Her mentor's email concluded by saying, "Your mother was very proud of you, and so am I." After 25 years with her company, 3 simple words carried more meaning than any other recognition Kristen had received in her entire life.
The magic ratio.
Of course, few moments are this profound, but even less memorable interactions are important. Positive psychology experts are finding that the frequency of small, positive acts is critical. John Gottman's pioneering research on marriages suggests there is a magic ratio of 5 to 1 in terms of our balance of positive to negative interactions. Gottman found that marriages are significantly more likely to succeed when the couple's interactions are near that 5 to 1 ratio of positive to negative. When the ratio approaches 1 to 1, marriages cascade to divorce. In a fascinating study, Gottman teamed up with 2 mathematicians to test this model. Starting in 1992, they recruited 700 couples who had just received their marriage licenses. For each couple, the researchers videotaped a 15-minute conversation between husband and wife and counted the number of positive and negative interactions. Then, based on the 5-to-1 ratio, they predicted whether each couple would stay together or divorce. 10 years later, Gottman and his colleagues followed up with each couple to determine the accuracy of their original predictions. The results were stunning. They had predicted divorce with 94% accuracy, based on scoring the couple's interactions for 15 minutes. This ratio is critical in the workplace as well. A recent study found that work groups with positive to negative interaction ratios greater than 3-to-1 are significantly more productive than teams that do not reach this ratio. Fredrickson and Losada's mathematical modeling of positive to negative ratios, however, also suggests the existence of an upper limit. Things can worsen if the ratio goes higher than 13-to-1. So while this book focuses primarily on ways to increase positive emotions, it's important to note that we don't recommend ignoring negativity and weakness. Positivity must be grounded in reality. A Pollyanna approach, in which the negative is completely ignored, can result in a false optimism that is counterproductive and sometimes downright annoying. There are times when it's absolutely necessary to correct our mistakes and figure out how to manage our weaknesses. But most of us don't have to worry about